because of the way He loves. We are saved from our sins. We have a hope of eternal life. And we have a promise of His presence throughout the difficulties and trials of this life. That's the way He loves. And we appreciate Him so much. And that's the reason that we come to offer our thanksgivings and our praise to Him. Thank you so much for being here this morning and for your love for the Lord. And for those of you who are visiting, we're glad that you've come to be with us this morning. It's good to see Pat Moreland out. She was in the hospital and is now going through dialysis, but she's able to be out this morning. It's good to see her here as well. We mentioned back a couple of weeks ago about, or last week, I think we talked about this last week, on evolution as opposed to creation. And we mentioned last time that the Bible teaches that God created the heavens and the earth. And we gave evidence for the existence of God and Him created the heavens and the earth back a few weeks ago. And the Bible affirms that, but the Bible also affirms that He did it in 6 days. If you notice in Exodus 20 and verse 11, "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." And someone might be thinking, well, what about evolution? If God created the heavens and the earth and made the heavens and the earth in 6 days, then that doesn't fit the theory of evolution. And evolution says that it was over a period of many, many millions and billions of years that all the life forms came into existence. Well, last week we began talking about evolution, and in the lesson this morning we want to again show that it is more reasonable to believe in creation than it is in the evolutionary theory. Let's first of all review some of the things that we talked about last week, and that is, it is very important that we understand what we mean by evolution. It's important to make a distinction between the general theory of evolution and the special theory of evolution. G.A. Kirkcutt, we quoted this last week, who was a well-known evolutionist. He says, "There is a theory which states that many living animals can be observed over the course of time to undergo changes so that new species are formed. This can be called the special theory of evolution and can be demonstrated in certain cases by experiments. On the other hand, there is a theory that all the living forms in the world have arisen from a single source, which itself came from an inorganic form. This theory can be called a general theory of evolution. The special theory of evolution says that there are changes within kinds of animals. That's sometimes called microevolution. And creationists accept this. There's observable indications of changes within kinds of animals. But then there's the general theory of evolution that claims that all the different life forms evolved from a single source of life, a single cell of life that over millions of years evolved into all the different life forms today. And so you have the special theory, which is also called microevolution, and the general theory, which is called macroevolution. And the special theory is changes within kinds, and the general theory is molecules to man evolution. Creationists do not object to or do not deny the special theory. We understand that there are changes that take place with animals within kinds of animals. But what we do object to is evolutionists taking the evidence for the special theory of evolution, for microevolution, and using that to prove the general theory of evolution. And that is what is done. And that's the reason it is so important to understand the distinction between the two, because much of the evidence that is presented to prove the general theory, macroevolution, really is only proving the special theory, or microevolution. What we mean by the general theory is all forms of life on Earth today came from some original form of life by a connected series of changes, and that this process is a fully natural process. This is the Adam, A-T-O-M, to Adam, A-D-A-M, evolution, in which there is no God and no first cause. You know, the Bible teaches that God brought forth the living creatures according to its kind. And I think it's important, we didn't talk about this in detail last time, but that the term kind that's found in the Bible is not synonymous with species according to the way man has categorized life. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 24 and 25, it says, "Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, and cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good." And he said that about vegetation in the third day. The fruit bearing seed according to its kind. And so we understand that there is the fish kind, there's the bird kind, there's the dog kind. And those are fixed. You don't find the fish kind evolving into the bird kind, or the dog kind evolving into the cat kind, whatever. You don't find that even in the evidence that is presented. You do find changes are within kinds of animals. And sometimes those changes may form different species according to the way that man has categorized the different life forms. But when you see that a new species has been developed, that doesn't mean a new kind has been developed. There's a difference. Now, in fact, species is kind of down at the bottom of the list. And I had the list, and I forgot to bring it with me. There's, you know, the kingdom, there's phyla, there are the different family. Those are above species. And I don't know where kind would fit into the way man is categorized, but I know that when the Bible talks about kinds, those are fixed forms of life that do not evolve, change into other kinds. And I want to say this, and I intended to say it beginning as I did last week, I'm not a biologist. I'm not a geologist, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a paleontologist or anthropologist. I'm not any of these are not my fields of study. But I have read, and we all can read, and the point I'm wanting to make is there are some simple things that we can look at, that we can know in nature, that tells us that evolution has not been proven. That is, the general theory of evolution has not been proven, and therefore, what we do see in the evidence around us fits more the creation model than it does the evolutionary model. We mentioned, and this is what I was wanting to look at when it talked about the kinds, is about Darwin's finches. You remember Darwin presented this as evidence of changes in kinds, and that was a bird. Darwin, on the island that he was on, I'll find it here in just a moment. Galapagos. There it is, the Galapagos Islands. That he saw these finches and how that they had changed over time as it relates to their sizes, their beaks, and so on. But really, a more thorough study was done of these finches back in the 1970s and 80s by Peter and Rosemary Grant. And I've got a quote here. This is from Josh Gertler's book, Unraveling Evolution. And here's what he says about their particular study of these finches. He says, "Not until the 1970s were the finches studied in depth by Peter and Rosemary Grant, who supposedly proved the evolution of these birds. On one of the smaller Galapagos Islands, the Grants caught, measured, banded, and released all medium and ground finches. They call them Finch K. After the drought of 1977, the Grants discovered that 85% of the population of finches died. The birds that were left were slightly larger in body mass and beak width. Gertler goes on to say, however, after the El Nino rains of 1983, the Grants discovered that the finches reverted to their original smaller size. Over time, then, the size of finches and finch beaks oscillated between larger and smaller with no appreciable long-term or evolutionary change. The researchers also discovered that some of the 14 species of finches were interbreeding and becoming much stronger, more healthy, and in the long run might have a better chance of surviving over the traditional species. They go on to say this type of improvement arises from intermingling of the gene pool known as hybrid vigor. These facts led many scientists to conclude that over time it is quite possible that the 14 species of finches might not be evolving into more diverse species. They might all be merging into one. Secondly, scientists have also concluded that the change in the beaks and body size of the birds due to climate change does not prove long-term evolutionary change. It only serves to prove that the finches oscillate in size from larger to smaller and then back again over time as one would expect any population of animals to do, variation within a kind. And then thirdly, because the finches' mating patterns are based on beak size and songs learned from parents and can interbreed with each other, the finches might not be 14 species after all. They might be just one. What do we find in the study of the finches? Well, changes within kinds. And that's all. Adaptation to environment. And that's what is the special theory. And all this proves is that microevolution does take place. But nothing in this proves that one kind of animal, as the Bible defines it, evolved into another kind. We also looked at last week at the general theory, macroevolution, has not been scientifically proven. Again, G.A. Kirkut said that the theory of evolution, the general theory, is based on seven assumptions. And he says the first point that I should like to make is that these seven assumptions, by their nature, are not capable of experimental verification. He also said the evidence that supports it, that is the general theory, is not sufficiently strong to allow us to consider it anything more than a working hypothesis. In other words, he doesn't even put it into the classification of a scientific theory. It's just a working hypothesis. And as we mentioned last time, for something to be proven scientifically, it must be observable, it must be repeatable, and it must be falsifiable. In other words, you must be able to conceive of an experiment, the failure of which would disprove the theory. Well, the general theory of evolution does not meet any of these criteria. And so it cannot be. It is impossible for it to be proven by the scientific method. We also mentioned last time that if the general theory is true, what would we expect? Well, we would expect that evidence for evolution would be found in the fossil record in the Earth's crust. And we show that evolutionists believe that. They believe that if it's going to be proven, that's where we're going to find the evidence. And I agree with that. But what do we find in the Earth's crust? Well, transitional forms in the fossil record showing one form of life gradually evolving into another, that's what we would expect if evolution, the general theory of evolution, be true. That there would be evidence within the fossil record, that is, these animals that were preserved through mineralization and maybe their forms against certain sedimentary rocks, that there would be evidence of these transitional forms from one kind to another. There would be, no doubt, millions of these animals. But not one fossil is found of the transitional forms between one kind to another. We would also expect, as scientists dug into the earth, they would find simple life forms in the lower strata, which would be the older rocks, and life forms would become more complex as they move higher, which would be the younger rocks, as the animals evolve from the simple-celled animals all the way up to the more complex animals, that you would find evidence of that as they would go up the geological column. But that's not what you find. What we talked about last week is the Cambrian explosion, which was the earliest layer, one of the earliest layers of where life forms are found. And there was an explosion of all different forms of life, complex forms of life. Now, we would expect that with the creation model, but that's not what you find with the evolutionary model. And so, we were saying that when you look at the evidence that is presented, and the evolutionists and the creationists have the same evidence, that what we do find in the fossil record, in the crust of the earth, is that which would fit better the creation model of life beginning abruptly, created, and then there the different kinds of life, the different kinds of animals are stasis, are fixed, and there is no evolution from one kind to another. And that's what we find in the fossil record. And so what we conclude from that, what do we learn from the fossil record? We learn that complex life forms on Earth began abruptly and not gradually. And we learn that there are no transitional forms that are necessary to prove the general theory of evolution. Therefore, the fossil record cries out creation, not evolution. And so, it is more reasonable to believe in divine creation than to believe in the general theory of evolution. Now, what I want to talk about this morning is concerning the mechanism of evolution. If evolution did occur, there has to be some mechanism by which it did occur. Now, evolution without a mechanism is like a car without an engine. It's not going to go anywhere. It may look like a car. It looks like it can move forward. But if it doesn't have a motor, it's not going to move. Well, the question is, how did the changes from one kind of animal to another kind occur in evolution? What brought it about? How did it occur? That's what we mean by mechanism. Well, evolutionists have had different views of that in times past, and maybe taught it as being fact. There is what is called the Lamarckian theory. Jean-Baptiste Lamarck believed that if organisms begin to use an organ more than they had in the past, it would increase in its lifetime. Others have used the giraffe as an example. The giraffe, how did they get their long necks? Well, as they would then reach for the leaves and the trees to eat, they couldn't get to some of those leaves, and so they would stretch. And as a result, there were certain fluids that would develop and help them to stretch their neck. Well, that one who did that and his neck was stretched could then pass that quality, that characteristic, on to his children. And then his children, who would have that long, little bit longer neck, could then do some more stretching, and their necks would get longer, and they could then pass that characteristic to their children, to the point that in time, the giraffe had the long neck. So acquired characteristics could be passed on to your children. In other words, if I worked out with weights, got strong, and my muscles were, I could then pass that characteristic on to my child. That was what was believed. And that was the mechanism of how these changes could take place. Well, scientists came to realize acquired traits cannot be transmitted. You cannot transmit what you have obtained through your own hard work onto your children. So that did not work. And Darwin came to understand that. And so you then have what is known as the Darwinism, and he claimed that was accomplished through natural selection. He viewed that nature has selected Darwin theorized that since most species produce far more offspring than can possibly survive to maturity, there will be an inevitable struggle for existence, and only the strongest or the fittest of the species will survive. Of course, the survival of the fittest. He then thought that these surviving individuals who are best fitted for their environment will then pass on their fitness to their offspring. Over time, these advantageous traits become more common in the population. Through this process of natural selection, favorable traits are transmitted through generations. And it's like you've heard of the peppered moth, and the moth that could camouflage itself, the white moths that could camouflage themselves against the lighter trees were camouflaged, and the birds wouldn't eat them, but the darker moths would then be eaten. And so what do you have? You have more of the white moths flourishing, and that trait then being promoted with among these moths. But the Industrial Revolution came in, the trees were darkened, where the dark moths could be more camouflaged than the white ones. And so the dark moths begin to flourish. In other words, you have natural selection where those traits that helped them to survive more would then be passed on. It was a part of their natural makeup of the animal, could be passed on to their posterity, to their progeny, and they would then pass that on. And that was how evolution then occurred. But evolutionists came to realize, though, for organisms to change from one kind to another, the genetic material must somehow change. In other words, through natural selection, it was what was already built within. But in order for there to be an actual change, those genetic changes had to take place. And so, as a result of Gregor Mendel's work, as he studied genetics, the genes, they come to realize that there are occasionally mutations of those genes. And those genes can be mutated and changed, and that could then sometimes be passed on to their children. Natural selection was not sufficient to explain the changes that must occur for macroevolution then to take place. So there began in about from the 1920s to the 1950s, particularly I think in the 1937, there came up with what it was known as neo-Darwinism. And this is also called the modern synthesis evolution. And that is that random mutation plus natural selection was the mechanism. That natural selection alone couldn't explain the changes that they were proposing. But mutations could. Random mutations could bring about a change in the gene form, and that could be passed on as beneficial genes or mutations occurred, and that could be passed on to children, and that's how these changes occurred. The Oxford Dictionary of Biology defines neo-Darwinism in this way. The current theory of the process of evolution formulated between 1920 and 1950 that combines evidence from classical genetics with the Darwinian theory of evolution by natural selection. It makes use of modern knowledge of genes and chromosomes to explain the source of genetic variation upon which selection works. This source was unexplained by traditional Darwinism. But there's problems with this mechanism as well. First of all, mutations are random. Dr. Henry M. Morris states that there is no way to control mutations to make them produce characteristics which might be needed. Natural selection must simply take what comes. In other words, nature is not selecting at all. Rather, nature is just pressed into accepting whatever appears with the mutations. And then, secondly, mutations are very rare. They're not common. And not only that, good mutations are very, very rare. As a matter of fact, H.J. Mueller, Nobel laureate in genetics, said, accordingly, the great majority of mutations, certainly well over 99%, over 99%, are harmful in some way, as is to be expected of the effects of accidental occurrences. So, this is not a good explanation. As a matter of fact, for Darwinian evolution to be true, what Josh Gertler says, persistent morphological beneficial mutations must occur. And what that means is that favorable structural changes must be passed on to the offspring. And let's just look at that. For Darwinian evolution to occur by mutation, three things are needed. First of all, the mutation must be persistent. In other words, it has to be a mutation that is successfully passed down to the next generation. If the animal is mutated, but the mutation is not passed down to the next generation, and some mutations are not, then it has nothing to do with Darwinian evolution. And then also, the mutation has to be morphological, meaning it has to be structural. It has to change. It has to bring about a change in the structure of the animal. You know, some mutations, and this is some of the evidence that's presented by evolutionists, as antibiotic resistance in bacteria or pesticide resistance. These are mutations. They are good mutations and can be good. And they say, well, see, there is, that's advantageous to the evolutionary theory. But with Darwinian evolution, the structure of the animal has to change. This is not evidence that structural change takes place. Gertler says, if the Darwinian theory was that a man evolved from sensitivity to poisons to resistance to poisons, then antibiotic resistance would prove that that to be true. But it doesn't. Darwinian evolution says that life evolved from a single cell organism to what? To something like a blue whale or the redwood trees of California. And so it's not just someone who is not resistant to poison now being resistant to poison. We're talking about a change in structure in order for the evolutionary, the Darwinian evolutionary theory to be true. In other words, it has to change the shape, the organs, the limbs of the animal if it's going to be a proof of the general theory of evolution. Well, there's no evidence of that. And also, in order for Darwinian evolution to occur, the mutations have to be beneficial. But remember what Mueller says, the great majority of mutations, certainly well over 99%, are harmful in some way. So, how many of these persistent morphological beneficial mutations have been found? The answer is zero, not one. They have not found one of these mutations that are required if the general theory of evolution is going to be true. What should it have done? Well, it should have caused them to abandon the theory a long time ago. Matter of fact, what we've already talked about, there's no transitional forms in the fossil record. Life began abruptly according to the fossil record. Fits more the creation model than the evolutionary model. And then when you look at the mechanism, there has to be a mechanism, and the mechanism that has been taught for many, many years continues to be taught. Of random mutations plus natural selection, it just doesn't fit what has happened. It's not evidence for the change that is required. Even if beneficial mutations could be found, the timetable needed for evolution to occur makes the process impossible. Consider with me this quote that's taken from Gertler's book. He says, George Gaylord Simpson, a well-known evolutionist, this is back in 1953, he admitted that even if there was a breeding population of 100 million individuals that produce new progeny every 24 hours, the chance of obtaining good evolutionary results from mutations would be once every 274 billion years. Once in 274 billion years. Gertler says, however, evolutionists expect us to believe that millions upon millions of evolutionarily beneficial mutations have occurred in transforming bacteria to Bob or microbe to Mary in their projected timeline of not greater than 3.8 billion years. It just doesn't fit. It causes us to see this is an impossibility. For changes to take place by random mutations, according to what we know about mutations, then it just could not have occurred. Well, there are evolutionists that admit that neo-Darwinism, that is the modern synthesis, when you see that phrase modern synthesis, it's talking about this mechanism of random mutation plus natural selection is dead. And just consider with me some quotes here. Many of you may know of a woman by the name of Lynn Margulis. She is an evolutionist, an American biologist, and university professor in the Department of Geosciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She is a world expert in evolution. She won the 2008 Darwin Wallace Medal, and that was a medal that was awarded every 50 years, going back to 1858 or something like that. Every 50 years, I think it's awarded more often than that now. Well, she won that award. It's awarded to a person or group who have made major advances in evolutionary science. Here is a highly respected evolutionist. She is the wife, or was the wife, of the late Carl Sagan, as many of you may know. Here are some quotes from Lynn Margulis. She says, I have seen no evidence whatsoever that these changes, evolutionary changes, has been inserted, can occur through the accumulation of gradual mutations. She also says, Darwin's claim of descent with modification as caused by natural selection is a linguistic fallacy. The source of purposeful inherited novelty in evolution, the underlying reason the new species appears, is not random mutation. She admits, this is not an explanation of how the changes have taken place. She says new mutations don't create new species. They create offspring that are impaired. She understands that's what you find in mutations. Most of them, over 99% of them, are harmful. Many of them are fatal to the animal. She says at that meeting, referring to a particular meeting, refers to a man by the name of Ayala, agreed with me when I said that this doctrinaire, neo-Darwinism, is dead. He was a practitioner of neo-Darwinism, but advances in molecular genetics, evolution, ecology, biochemistry, and other views had led him to agree that the neo-Darwinism is dead. And so this idea of the mechanism being random mutation plus natural selection, that doesn't explain it, is what she's saying. Another evolutionist by the name of Coonan says, the edifice of the modern synthesis, neo-Darwinism, has crumbled apparently beyond repair. All major tenets of the modern synthesis are, if not outright overturned, replaced by a new and incomparably more complex vision of the key aspects of evolution. So, not to mince words, the modern synthesis is gone. What's next? We'll talk about that in just a moment. Also, Padian said, how do major evolutionary changes get started? Does anyone still believe that populations sit around for tens of thousands of years waiting for favorable mutations to occur? And just how does that happen, by the way? Then anxiously guard them until enough accumulate for a selection to push the population toward new and useful change? There you have the mathematical arguments of neo-Darwinism that Waddington and others rightly characterize as vacuous, meaning empty, useless. In other words, he's saying this is not an explanation. Now, what we're seeing here is there's a debate among evolutionists over these issues. And well-known evolutionists recognize that neo-Darwinism is dead. Not only is neo-Darwinism dead, but evolutionists really don't know what to replace it with. There are many who have claimed neo-Darwinism, random mutation plus natural selection, is not the mechanism. Well, what next? Well, here's what Fodor and then Piotelli, Palamarini stated in 2010. In fact, we don't know very well how evolution works. Nor did Darwin. And nor, as far as we can tell, does anybody else. Further research is required, as the saying goes. It may be that centuries of further research are required. We think that what is needed is to cut the tree at its root, to show that Darwin's theory of natural selection is fatally flawed. Cut that down. We really don't know. We're just going to start searching. The point is, they're not giving up the theory of evolution. What they're doing is saying that evolution is a fact, and we're going to look for evidence for it. The evidence has to be there somewhere. Professor Henry Schrader said there is no plausible scientific mechanism for the origin of life, the apparent appearance of the first self-replicating biochemical system. I find no satisfactory mechanism for macroevolutionary change. If neo-Darwinism is dead, does this mean that macroevolution is rejected? Here's what Gertler says. He says, unfortunately, the answer to that question is no. Remember, these are men and women of great faith. They believe that macroevolution must be true, even with no mechanism as to how it occurred. For example, evolutionist Barry Price said, and he quotes him, while evolution is a fact, how it occurs will always be the subject of debate. This is the fascination of science. To put it another way, there is no dispute about the fact that evolution has occurred, but there is dispute among scientists about how it has occurred. And then Gertler says, from the failure of neo-Darwinism has arisen a multitude of competing evolutionary hypotheses. However, no one can agree on which mechanism to accept, because most of them seem even harder to believe than neo-Darwinism. And he lists in his book, I don't know, 21, 23 explanations that have been given by evolutionists of how it happened, what the mechanism is. And they don't know. One of them is what is known as punctuated equilibrium, that the changes must have happened in spurts rather than gradual, as Darwin said. Well, okay, but there's no evidence of that. No one was there to observe it. No one has ever observed this to take place. So it's not scientific. What is it? It's a what many people claim of us as Christians to be, a projection of a wish. That's what many people claim our belief in God is, a projection of a wish. Well, no, we've got evidence that there is a God. We have evidence that the Bible is the Word of God, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and there's good reasons. But what they have in their belief in the general theory of evolution is really a projection of a wish. It is a faith. It's like many religious people who are not going to give it up no matter what facts they find. And they're not going to give this up because they truly believe that it happened. And why? Well, they're people of biases and they've got prejudices. They've got their own way of living and how they want to live that's going to affect the conclusions that they come to. And I'm sure many of them gives the evolutionary theory from amoeba to man, molecules to man concept, gives the idea that there is no God. There's no one that I am accountable to who created me. I can live the way I want to live. And that's really the basis, I'm sure, for many who come to this conclusion. It affects their desire and how they want to live their life. It's not always science. They claim to be scientists. They have PhDs and a lot of different degrees after their names. But that doesn't mean they're always telling us the truth. Matter of fact, many of them have lied to us about this. And so we need to be skeptical of the skeptics. That is, of those who are skeptical of us, we need to be skeptical of them. And recognize that we just don't follow whatever they say. You'll find that many people that claim that they believe in evolution is because that's what they have been told. Not because they have seen the evidence, it's because they have been told that by some professor. Maybe they read it in a magazine, they saw it on National Geographic TV, or whatever. They saw that, and that's the reason that they believe it. My point is that when you look at the evidence that we all have, that the evolutionists and the creationists agree upon, that has been observed, it fits better the creation model. It's not a reason for us to abandon our faith in God, but it's a reason to say it corroborates the faith that we have in God. With all the other evidence that we have looked at for the existence of God. So, what have we learned? We've learned that the general theory of evolution, that is macroevolution, is not and cannot be proven a scientific fact. Those who accept it by faith. The fossil record best fits the creation model of origins rather than the evolution model. And evolutionists really don't know how macroevolution occurs. They believe it, but they don't know how it occurred. I hope some things we've said have been helpful to you as you look at this. If you believe I have said things that were wrong, I would really appreciate it if you would come to me and tell me that, because I will change it. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a biologist or a geologist. So I'm reading and quoting what other people have said. So, but feel free to correct me in anything that I've said that's wrong. We're believers in God, but we're believers in God because we know that He exists. He is real. And we've come here to worship Him today. Our lives are based on that faith, where we are determined to put into practice His will for our life, to fulfill His purpose for our life. There may be some here this morning who have not been living that kind of life. Maybe you've rejected God. You rejected Jesus. When you know that God does exist, you know the Bible is the Word of God and that Jesus is the Son of God. But don't turn your back on Him any longer. Come to Him. Give your life to Him. If you don't know what you need to do, we'll sit down and talk with you about it. If you're not sure whether these things are true or not, we'll sit down and look at the evidence. But do what you need to do to find out what the truth is, and then put that into practice. And if you know what you need to do and you haven't been doing it, please come while together we stand and sing.